Welcome to Oncology Today, optimizing the selection of first-line therapy for patients with multiple myeloma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Saad Usmani from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Usmani's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to comment on his vision on the optimal time to initiate treatment for myeloma, specifically for patients with smoldering disease.
So when we looked at the smoldering myeloma patient population from historic data sets at the Mayo Clinic and the Spanish myeloma group, it was clear that burden of disease correlated with the likelihood of disease progression. That's why the initial staging criteria of creating risk profiles of patients who would progress to active disease included things like M spike values and the percentage of plasma cells in the bone marrow, the light chain ratio. But then more recently, we've recognized that it also has to do with disease biology. So there are certain translocation patients like 4/14/16/14/20, or translocation 4/14 patients that may progress at a faster pace compared to someone who may have the similar kind of disease burden in the smoldering space. So, and the third important thing is the immune paresis phenomenon that we see. So the immune system just getting exhausted, and that leads to this expansion of bad guys and organ damage. So what I'm trying to get at is we know that even that the smoldering myeloma subset is heterogeneous. We have tried to utilize the burden of disease to define risk of progressing to active myeloma. And we have changed the myeloma definition about 10 years ago to include the ultra high risk smolderers to active disease. And I do feel that in the next few years, we might actually change that definition even further and may even qualify the current high risk smoldering myeloma patients to active myeloma. And the more we dissect that subgroup, we will eventually come up with a category of patients who may have a gammopathy that will never develop a problem. And for any patient with gammopathy who we know will have a risk of progression, we will intervene early.
What about right now for practical purposes, sort of outside a clinical trial? What are the situations, if any, where you will treat a patient who sort of fits the current definition of smoldering disease?
So I would say for high-risk smoldering disease within that category of smoldering patients, and if someone is in their 70s, we now have three randomized clinical trials that are showing that if you intervene with a single agent, there are two trials that looked at lenalidomide, one trial that was just presented at ASH looking at daratumumab. I think it's reasonable to have that discussion with the patient about utilizing the single agent for 2 or 3 years, just like it was done in the clinical trials. Will I do this for all smoldering myeloma patients? The answer is no.
But you have done it?
So I will start to do it now, you know, because we just got the third clinical trial is, you know, is more convincing. This was the Aquila trial that was just presented at ASH, looking at daratumumab compared to observation.
Okay, and another sort of global question. I've seen you've written about this. Are there any situations right now where you think it's reasonable to hold off on not using an anti-CD38 antibody as part of first-line therapy in either transplant-eligible or ineligible patients?
So just to reiterate the question is, are there populations that I wouldn't use a quadruplet induction? Is that the question?
Well, I was going to say it doesn't have to be quadruplet, but I'm talking about just the CD38 antibody.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, anti-CD38 antibodies are, one of the easier treatments to give in our armamentarium in terms of the safety profile. So unless someone is hypersensitive to them, I don't see a reason why a patient cannot get an anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody. So I wouldn't exclude any patients.
What are the situations where right now, again, outside of a clinical trial, you're using anti-CD38 antibody as maintenance therapy, either alone or, for example, with lenalidomide?
So for high-risk patients who are unable to tolerate a proteasome inhibitor with lenalidomide, Dara and lenalidomide are reasonable, or isatuximab lenalidomide would be a reasonable choice for maintenance in those settings. For standard risk patients who have achieved MRD negativity or good depth of response, I'm okay with using a single drug as maintenance, but those who still remain MRD positive, those are the patients I would consider an anti-CD38 lenalidomide as maintenance treatment.
So you also mentioned and you discussed in your talk the new definition of high risk. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that, the thinking that went into that, and what the difference is with the new system that's come out compared to the one we have right now?
So the ISS and the revised ISS staging system relied on albumin, LDH, beta 2 microglobulin, and did not include all the biologic information that informs outcomes in patients. So it was a mix of disease burden related features and some biologic features. And the key concept here is that we have to focus on disease biology. And we have very effective treatments now that are actually even improving outcomes for some of the high-risk features that were that we previously thought were high-risk features. For example, isolated translocation 414 patients are doing exceptionally well compared to how they used to be in the past with triplet and quadruplet induction treatment. So do they really need to be in the high-risk category? On their own, they don't. But if translocation 414 is there with other abnormalities, we would consider that as high-risk. So it's a shift, it's a paradigm shift from that standpoint that we're paying more attention to disease biology rather than clinical indices.
Another sort of broad general question, we'll get into this with your cases as well, but just sort of conceptually in terms of the idea of quadruplet and specifically the issue of whether to use a proteasome inhibitor in an older patient, 85, 90 years old. Previously, we had this discussion about so-called RVD light. Now we have obviously anti-CD38 antibodies in the mix, which sounds like in general you're going to be including in these older patients. But what about whether or not to use a proteasome inhibitor? Are you pretty much giving everybody, regardless of age or performance status, a quad? Or are there some people where you hold off on the proteasome inhibitor?
For the frail patients, we do hold off on the proteasome inhibitor, and that's where an anti-CD38 dose-attenuated lenalidomide, dose-attenuated dexamethasone would make sense. And based on the tolerability and response, you can tweak the dosing and schedule a little bit more. But, that's the population that I would withhold a proteasome inhibitor. And then for the fit or intermediate fit patients, if I use the proteasome inhibitor, I want to use it for the first 4 or 6 months of treatment. And I want to attenuate the dose if they're having any side effects. But the real idea is reduce the burden of disease as quickly as possible, and then you can back off.
In terms of your, quote, definition of frail, do you use any specific geriatric indices, or is it more kind of an eyeball test?
So we have the International Myeloma Working Group Frailty Score or Frailty Index, and we now even have what's called the Simplified IMWG frailty score. They are available as tools online, and there's an app as well. You can calculate it while you're in clinic, and we typically utilize those tools in determining eyeball test is no longer valid, although that had been in use quite a bit in the past.
So another sort of broad general question is choice of anti-CD38 antibody for practical purposes outside of a clinical trial, also including the issue of access and FDA approvals as part of the thought, and also, I guess, the issue of currently we have sub-Q DARA but not sub-Q ISA, although I don't know what the timetable is for sub-Q ISA and how that device plays out. I'm curious if you've had any experience with it. But any thoughts about the choice of anti-CD38 antibody in the upfront setting?
So I do feel that both the antibodies work well for patients. You know, they're very similar in terms of efficacy. We've seen this in multiple clinical trials in the relapse setting, as well as in the frontline setting. And just the data that I showed you kind of resonates with that. You know, IMROZ and Cepheus, very similar kind of results in the frontline setting. So you can't go wrong with either of them. I think, you know, it will really depend on the comfort of the physicians and the patients. There are some differences in, like you said, route of administration as well as the schedule. And so, you know, patients and physicians may have preference for one over the other, which is, you know, which can be discussed in the clinic. And the subcutaneous formulation of isatuximab, I think, may come in the next year or two, and it will be a more convenient thing for our patients, especially if they have this on-body product that they are developing, and they're also going to explore whether it can be administered to patients outside of the clinic. So we'll just have to wait and see. But, you know, I don't honestly see a differentiation between these products. It will have to be a comfort level and schedule issue between the patient and the doctor.
Have you think back of patients who you started on therapy in the last year? Have you started any patients outside a clinical trial on isatuximab as part of induction therapy?
Well, you know, the frontline approval just came, I believe, in late summer. So our program has utilized isatuximab in the clinic. We also have, you know, some clinical trials where we're using isatuximab in the frontline setting as well.
So, I mean, again, I'm just trying to think practically. And also curious about how it goes with the infusion reaction to isatuximab and how you would compare that experience to a patient getting daratumumab. And again, is there a clinical situation where you would prefer outside a clinical trial using isatuximab?
No, again, you know, I mean, these are very similar products. So infusion-related reactions are not as big of a concern with these products compared to, say, rituximab, you know, in the B-cell malignancy world and others. And our colleagues out in the community are very well versed with dealing with infusion-related reactions and managing them. So that learning curve issue that was there 8 or 9 years ago is no longer there. I think, you know, everyone is familiar with it. And I don't think that there is a differentiator between, you know, using one product versus the other for any patient populations.
So let's go through your cases. These are actual patients you took care of?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, so let's hear about this 79-year-old African-American woman.
All right, so this is a very, you know, interesting case with, you know, fairly active patient, still working part-time, mostly a desk job, but presented with increasing fatigue and found to have renal insufficiency along with the normocytic anemia. And just looking at the primary care records, the serum total protein levels had been steadily going up over the last four years or so. And in the last year, the serum albumin had taken a hit. So The patient did get a serum protein electrophoresis done because of these findings, amongst the other anemia workup, and found to have a 2.1 gram per deciliter M spike of IgG kappa isotype, and the kappa light chain values were also elevated. The bone marrow biopsy demonstrated 65% plasma cells with kappa light chain restriction. The FISH studies were consistent with translocation 11-14. And the skeletal survey that was done by the local oncology clinic demonstrates several lucencies in the vertebral spine and pelvis consistent with lytic lesions. So just looking at the staging criteria using the revised ISS staging criteria, they were staged as revised ISS stage 2.
And can you talk about what your thoughts were, or how you would think through this sort of from a teaching point of view in terms of the options that would be a consideration, and then actually what happened with this patient?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, for this particular patient, the things that we have to think about is, you know, would we consider this patient, you know, fit, intermediate fit, or frail? And what would be the options of therapies for this patient, whether we would pick a triplet induction regimen for them or a quadruplet induction to start off with before before changing over to the maintenance treatment. So with a single drug. So those were some of the discussions that you would like to have, you know, with these patients. So given her age, given the fact that she had standard risk disease, and she, her ECOG performance status at baseline was zero, but had declined to around two by the time the patient presented with symptomatic disease, I would be picking a daratumumab-based triplet like Dara-Lendex, so following the Maya clinical trial for a patient like this.
And what actually happened with the patient?
So that's exactly what we did for this patient. It took the patient about 14 cycles of treatment before they got to a very good partial response. I had started them on a lower dose of lenalidomide at 10 milligrams and actually reduced the lenalidomide to 5 milligrams after the first four cycles because of ongoing fatigue issues. And at the 5 milligrams, she was able to tolerate it better. And the patient continues on the same treatment, and they are now 4+ years out in sustained remission on now single agent maintenance treatment with monthly daratumumab.
So you mentioned the DEX, and I noticed you had a paper, or you're part of a paper looking at the issue of dosing of DEX, which I hear from the oncologists in the community is, for practical purposes, you know, an issue, particularly in older patients. Can you comment on what you found there and how you think through dosing of DEX?
Yeah, so in our clinical practice, dexamethasone is typically dialed down after the initial few cycles of treatment. Especially in older patients, we usually don't even start from the full 40 milligram dose. It's either 20 milligrams or even for some patients, we start at 12 milligrams once weekly. And then after the initial, when we know that the patients are responding, we can reduce the dose further. And my personal preference is after initial 6 months of treatment, I try to discontinue the dexamethasone altogether in patients. The paper that was just published in Blood actually looked at the SWOG 777 patient population, which was a randomized phase 3 study looking at RVD versus RD as induction for newly diagnosed patients. And the SWOG 1211 trial which was the first randomized trial for high-risk patients. And that trial looked at ELO RVD versus RVD as induction. Then everyone got RV or Len and bortezomib as maintenance treatment in that particular trial. But the question was, let's take a look at the outcomes of patients who actually had reductions in dexamethasone dosing compared to those who continued on the study protocol with the same dose of dexamethasone. And the outcomes were not different. So the point being made that you can reduce the dose of dexamethasone without compromising the outcomes. And this is something that has already been shown in the older population by our European colleagues. So there was a Lendex versus Len low dex, and then discontinuing the dex altogether and just doing Len as maintenance study that was done by our Italian myeloma colleagues, published a few years ago, showed the same thing, that if you continue with the high dose, you know, the regular dose of dex with lenalidomide, or you discontinue it after a few months of induction and just keep Len going, the outcomes are similar. So so for all practical purposes, it's okay to use dex early on and get that bang for the buck in terms of response, but then it's okay to dial it down and then discontinue in patients.
This woman had T1114 and curious, obviously venetoclax, BCL2 inhibition is an issue in relapse disease. Any trials or any thoughts about bringing up earlier?
So venetoclax off-label use has been done in patients in their first or second relapse. I'm not sure if venetoclax is going to be following a regulatory path anymore, but there are other novel BCL2 inhibitors. There's one that the company BeiGene is developing. It's I believe it's called sonotoclax, and there's another... Yeah, and there's another one, ABV453. So they're in clinical trials. We've seen some preclinical data with one of them. We've seen clinical data with one of them. And I wouldn't be surprised if there is a frontline induction treatment trial being planned for 1114 patients with one or both of them in the future.
Yeah, I think I saw some data on that. Sonotoclax first line with zanubrutinib in CLL at ASH, so it's interesting to see where that's heading. I'm curious, so now this lady at this point is, what, 84, 85 years old?
Yeah, so, I mean, if we look at the first clinical trial, you know, that the trial that had looked at Lendex for fixed duration versus continuous, if you look at the median overall survival for those patients in the clinical trials, I think it was around 5 or 6 years for the older patient population. And now we're talking about 8 to 9 years or even more for that older patient population. So it's remarkable to see patients who are older, frail, get the triplet induction like an anti-CA38 Lendex and continuing to do well. And of course, they're going to have competing risks for morbidity and mortality with other health issues. But, you know, it's good to see that myeloma is not the key issue bothering them.
So the thing I was wondering about is when you think about her when she presented at age 79, four or five years ago, and you think about her today, when you look at her, do you think she would be a candidate for CAR T?
So at this age, there are other options that may give her a better quality of life. So I would probably put CAR T on the back burner for someone like this. And, you know, there are other potential options if she does have a disease relapse at this point. But, you know, if I had an option to give her a bispecific versus CAR T cell therapy, I would probably give her a bispecific rather than a CAR T-cell therapy.
I was actually thinking about, you know, some of the discussions, and I think I saw you part of a paper bringing up the question of CAR T versus auto transplant. and whether or not at the age of 79, obviously you felt she wasn't a candidate for transplant, but what do you think at 79 it would have been a candidate for CAR T? And do you think that in the future, maybe we would give people like this induction therapy and then CAR T?
Yeah, so if you're asking the question, if she was presenting today at the age of 79 and we had CAR T available, at the age of 79, with how her performance status was at that time, I would have considered induction followed by a CAR T for this patient. We have an ongoing clinical trial called the CARTITUDE 5 study asking that same question with VRDS induction followed by CAR T. And that's a fixed duration treatment. And if this patient wanted that kind of an approach, I think it would have been reasonable to consider it. CAR T is more palatable than transplant for sure for someone in their late 70s.
Okay, let's go into your second case. Now we have a younger patient, 63-year-old man.
Yeah, so this is a 63-year-old gentleman, quite an active guy, does a lot of cycling and has done some really strenuous kind of bike rides in the United States as well as outside the United States. And they had presented, they actually got hospitalized after a cycling accident and they had a compression fracture. But when they presented with severe pain, they were found to have normocytic anemia, renal insufficiency, and hypercalcemia at admission. So they got worked up very quickly and were found to have active myeloma. And interestingly, on the FISH analyses, they had double hit disease. So they had translocation 414 as well as deletion 17p. So this is an ultra high risk kind of a patient. They had multiple osteolytic lesions in addition to multi-level compression fractures and on PET scan and quite high SUV values throughout the various osteolytic lesions. So clearly a high-risk patient, an ultra-high-risk patient where you want to pick the best treatments for your patient and try to get them into a good response.
So can you talk about what you saw as the potential options for a patient, the high-risk like this, and what actually happened?
So in the interest of time, since they were in the hospital, they got bisphosphonates. They did get two doses, weekly doses of bortezomib with cyclophosphamide and dexamethasone. And then when they came out on the outpatient side, they received a quadruplet induction. So they got Dara-KRd as part of their induction treatment and then went on to get a VGPR as response after induction, and it had kind of plateaued. So they were not getting into MRD negativity after induction treatment. The patient then proceeded to an autologous stem cell transplant, and they got MRD negativity at 10 to the minus 5, but not at 10 to the minus 6. PET scan actually did show resolution of the FDG avid lesions. And so I placed this patient on carfilzomib and len as maintenance treatment. And that was about 3 years ago. And they are still in an MRD negative status at 10 to the minus 5, 3 years out from their transplant. And actually enjoying their quality of life. They're not back to cycling again, but they're running and they're swimming and they went out with some family members on an exotic hike recently. Getting back to that active routine. For someone like this, if they were diagnosed 15 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to share that kind of a story. So it's remarkable for even double hit kind of myelomas to see something like this happen.
That really is remarkable. What about Dara maintenance in a patient like this?
So if they had not tolerated carfilzomib as maintenance, I would have preferred an anti-CA38 len as maintenance for them. But, you know, we have a lot more data of using a PI IMiD maintenance for high-risk patients than we do with Dara-Len. So I'm just starting to get comfortable with that idea. I would really like to see more data from Ischia, longer follow-up on Ischia and Perseus for high-risk patients specifically. Then, of course, the GMMG HD7 trial so that, you know, I can be more comfortable using an anti-CA38 doublet for high-risk patients.
Can you talk a little bit in general about your approach to a patients who present with renal failure, even patients with more severe renal failure, for example, needing dialysis?
Yeah, certainly. So it depends on the acuity of the renal insufficiency. You can have patients who had this gradual onset of renal insufficiency over many months until they get to this, you know, stage 4 or stage 5, where the likelihood of reversing that damage is, you know, the longer they have the damage, the less likelihood that we'd be able to recover their function completely. So if they had a normal renal function 2 or 3 months ago and they're just presenting with this explosive presentation, I think as soon as you start the initial myeloma treatment, the renal function should improve or get back to normalcy. However, if it's been percolating for many months, the likelihood of success is going to be lower. And that's where you have to plan treatments accordingly. You'll have to modify the dose of immunomodulatory drugs. You might even have to consider using cyclophosphamide instead of an immunomodulatory drug in those patients in your triplet or quadruplet regimen. But you know, early on, if patients are presenting with renal insufficiency that is more acute in nature, and they're on hemodialysis, it's likely they will come off of dialysis. But if it's been there for a while, then it will become a challenge in having them come off of dialysis. The other consideration there is, of course, you know, in addition to just myeloma burden-related renal insufficiency, whether there's a component of amyloidosis or light chain deposition, because that plays a role in our treatment decision-making as well.
What about anti-CD38 antibodies in patients with renal insufficiency?
I think it's reasonable to use. There's no contraindication. It's just that when patients are admitted to the hospital, it's hard to give an anti-CD38 because of formulary and or reimbursement issues, but we can certainly give it as soon as they're in the outpatient setting.
This patient had a creatinine of 4.2. How long did it take to normalize?
So this was an acute presentation, and this normalized by the time they were starting their initial induction. So, you know, the creatinine came down to normal after the first month of treatment, essentially.
Okay, let's talk about your third case, the 72-year-old man.
Yeah, so this is actually a more recent case and, you know, quite an interesting situation because, you know, in absence of the IMROS and Cepheus data, you know, the approach for this patient would be somewhat different. So this is a 72-year-old patient who presented with back pain that wasn't getting better. The primary care physician did an x-ray of the lumbar spine and there were numerous lytic lesions. And then, you know, the workup showed anemia, the workup showed mild renal insufficiency. The serum calcium was a little elevated as well. Patient had lambda light chains on immunofixation, and they were elevated on the serum protein electrophoresis. So really lambda light chain myeloma with 45% plasma cells on the bone marrow biopsy, and the patient did have translocation port 14. PET scan was positive, 3 FDG avid lesions. By revised ISS staging criteria, this patient met the ISS stage 3 because the beta 2 microglobulin was elevated. So it's a, you know, this is a translocation 414 patient. We know that with isolated translocation for 14, they behave in an intermediate fashion. So he's right at the cusp of being considered transplant eligible, right? You know, he's a transplant eligible patient in my mind. And I would like to start him on a quadruplet induction and then try to take him to a transplant.
How would you think through options for a patient in this situation? And what did you decide to do and what happened?
Yeah, so this patient, got started on a quadruplet induction regimen and had an excellent response, went into a complete response within two cycles. Pain and all of those issues got better. After four cycles of induction, the patient got to MRD negativity status at 10 to the minus 5. We talked about stem cell transplant. The patient wanted to collect the stem cells and store them and use the transplant at first relapse and just continue with maintenance treatment. So for this patient, we decided as a team, you know, the patient and the doctor, to follow the Cepheus and IMROS clinical trial model. In the Cepheus trial, 20% of the patients enrolled were transplant deferred patients. So they were patients who wanted to collect their stem cells but use the transplant at their first relapse. So this patient went on, moved on to Dara-Len as maintenance treatment. This is a very recent case, and they've done their stem cell collection, and if the myeloma acts up in the next few years, we can revisit whether using that autologous stem cell transplant would be something to do for this patient. The reason why I want to share this case is this is, by the revised IST staging, a high-risk patient with a good initial response with MRD negativity. But again, with 414 patients, that's what you typically do see, a very rapid response. But I'll have to wait and see what happens. If the disease acts up, we might have to do an auto for them.
Can you talk a little bit about how you approach patients who theoretically, like this man, would be eligible for autologous transplant? What your thoughts are about the risks and benefits? Do you generally favor a transplant, And also whether you counsel patients differently if they're African American?
No, I don't counsel patients, based on race and ethnicity. I do feel that, we have to kind of level the playing field from that perspective and give all patients the same benefit and chance. This patient is transplant eligible in my mind. The reason why I'm presenting this data is because IMROS and Cepheus is informing patients' own decision-making as well. My argument here for someone like this would be that they are never going to be this young again, and their tolerability for an autologous stem cell transplant would be better now compared to 3 or 4 years from now if the myeloma does come back. And they should have it now rather than later. We have to abide by what the patient's wishes are in light of data, and if the median PFS with a Cepheus or IMROS approach is going to be 5 or 6 or 7 years. I'm just making up that number. We'll see what those numbers will look like, and the patients are happy with that outcome. And that approach takes this patient from the age of 72 to the age of 79 at the first relapse. I'm okay with that decision for that patient.
I brought up the issue of African-American because of the determination trial, where it looked like the benefit of transplant was not as clear-cut as it was in Caucasian patients. Any thoughts about that? And, they presented some data bringing up the idea of, Duffy-Nil, somehow maybe it's a biologic issue.
Yeah, I think One of the challenges with the determination clinical trial or any clinical trial where you try to do post hoc analyses and you had not planned that experiment or research question ahead of time is that you start comparing 5 patients to 9 patients in subgroups and you cannot come up with even hypothesis generating ideas. So, I would just caution that, that I wouldn't read too much into the determination data set for these smaller cohorts of patients because, it doesn't really inform my practice or any good scientific rationale. So I don't buy it.
I'd like to close out here with some of your thoughts about where things might be heading in the next few years. And one thing I wanted to ask you about was a presentation at ASH of the so-called COSMIC study. We were talking about frail patients. This is a SWOG 2209. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting clinical trial. And the main idea of that clinical trial was we do not have a head-to-head comparison of bortezomib lendex versus dara lendex for the older patient population. And outside of the SWOG trial, I don't think we'll ever get another study that's comparing these regimens. So one arm of the study is, the SWOG 777 trial, which is VRD induction and then len index as maintenance. And the other two arms are the dara lendex containing arms, but one arm has a further attenuation of maintenance strategy after the initial 9 cycles of induction with dara lendex. And the third arm is just, straight Maya clinical trial kind of an approach. I think that trial is commendable. I wonder whether we'd be able to get a clear answer from the trial, in the right time frame before the standard of care treatment actually changes for these patients. It is a good idea. I hope that we are able to enroll patients, and it will inform whether to use a PI or an anti-CA38 with Lendex. But I suspect that by the time the trial reads out, the question may have already been answered by other smaller studies.
So one final issue I'd like to hear your thoughts on is obviously you were bringing up MRD so many times in your talk. It's really been fully integrated into the ongoing and now future trials. Can you talk a little bit about your vision about where things are heading in terms of the use of MRD? And for practical purposes, in what situations right now do you see the value of MRD assays in community-based clinical practice?
Right now, I think it's prognostic, but very soon it will become a treatment decision tool where we would be able to define the duration of maintenance treatment for patients. So Adaptive is the commercially available assay. It's the one that's been utilized for clinical trials as well. The flow-based assay is there at most academic centers and can supplement the Adaptive test as well. But if I'm a community physician treating any cancer patient, I would like to be able to prognosticate my patients with full confidence. And that's what the MRD test helps us achieve. Even when patients have complete response, if they are MRD positive, they're going to have a shorter progression-free survival compared to someone who's MRD negative. So as a clinician, I would like to be able to tell my patient that hey, you're MRD negative, we'll continue to follow you, but I don't think you have to worry as much about an early relapse. Whereas for the MRD positive patient, you want to provide better prognostic information and say, hey, this is what happens for MRD positive patients. We'll keep a closer eye on you, and especially, given these findings. I think it's patients need to know, instead of giving them a range, yeah, the myeloma can come back in 2 years, in 5 years, in 10 years, who knows. So MRD test will give better, more confidence to the clinician to provide that information to their patients.
I guess the one practical clinical situation I've heard people talk about is whether or not to discontinue maintenance therapy in a patient who's MRD negative.
Yeah, we don't have that information yet. And this is where the big SWOG 1803 trial will help, because that particular trial is looking at discontinuation after 3 years of maintenance and being MRD negative, and the randomization is half of the patients stop, half of the patients continue. And it's a big study, over 1,500 patients enrolled, and that will tell us what's the right approach. At MSK, we did a study of lenalidomide discontinuation after 3 years of MRD negativity. I can tell you that for standard risk patients, most of them are still off lenalidomide maintenance, but the high-risk patients are the ones who are relapsing sooner. So that's where, you know, my comment about dual maintenance and then maybe a longer duration of MRD negativity for those patients before considering discontinuation in the future. But yeah, I mean, I don't think we have enough data to say that we can discontinue maintenance. There are some physicians who are doing it, but they're doing it in absence of any randomized data.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Usmani, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.